This is Directional, a podcast about video games and the creative rebellion. With Chantal Ryan and Jörg Tittel.
I mean, what's beautiful about being here at Gamescom with you again, Chantal, is how human scale this whole thing is, isn't it?
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah, it's so odd. Last year, so dear listeners, we are recording this on one of the rare sort of calm spots around this thing. What is Gamescom? What does Gamescom, Chantal, to you? What does it mean to you?
Oh my God, Gamescom is a chaos of the washed and unwashed masses mingling together to consume joy and horror in equal parts.
Yeah. Do they give any of it back, do you think?
Who?
Well, those that consume the joy.
Well, I think some do.
They do, right?
Some do. You know, it's a big community. There are a lot of people who are in it for some very particular reasons that don't really consider what the human cost or value or investment or return on investment is. But then there are a lot of true artists running around who are genuinely passionate about the projects they're working on, the ways they can change things. We have allies.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff to cut through to kind of find that gold in the pile of steaming sweat and gas that is Gamescom.
Today, for instance, I wanted to go to the public area to go to the Sega booth, not because I actually particularly want to play anything there, but I wanted to see this Sonic the Hedgehog statue that's there that I, as a kid, used to see at Sega World, which was this sort of arcade in London near Piccadilly Circus called Sega World. And Sonic the Hedgehog sort of balancing a globe on a finger and sort of like spinning it on his finger, a super cool, like really large statue. And then it disappeared. Like, the Sega World shut down. I think it was sort of 2002 or something like that. That shut down. And then after that he vanished. But he was just rediscovered last year.
Wow.
In a sort of garage, somewhere, like storage shed thing, whatever, somewhere south of the river in London. So bizarrely. It was found there, and they bizarrely had forgotten about their own history in this game industry, which is surprising, isn't it? No, it happens all the time. It's like everything is sort of expendable, but there's one guy in the company at Sega that really, really cared, Danny Russell, a dear friend of mine, and he just made it his project to get it restored, and he contacted me and said, York, do you know anyone who could restore this thing? And I'm like, yeah, talk to my friend Dan, who's a special effects artist and has his own, you know, shop where he builds monsters and, you know,
Dan
stuff.
Who?
Dan Martin. He will have to be a guest on the show. Dan, you're coming on the show. He's an incredible guy. And he works with Brandon Cronenberg and, you know, Ben Wheatley, and does all these amazing films. And so his workshop restored it. And it's here. It's here at Gamescom. So in a way, I'm proud of the fact I'm involved with the one historical, cultural, physical object that is in this massive hall where everything
that you know of.
Yeah, no, that yeah,
could
no, that
be
I know
some
of.
Ancient hidden sword treasures lying around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I want more of that. I want to go to a festival where actually things are, and to a conference or whatever, where things are actually physical and meaningful. Because here, I was thinking about the amount of trash that this will generate at the end.
Oh, God, yeah. Every stand has its little kind of plastic sleeve enclosed sticker, or a little like keychain knickknack.
It's insane.
It's rough, but it, like, to be fair, you look in a supermarket and, you know, the amount of trash that goes through just a supermarket on a regular street corner every day is, you know, very much putting out a lot of stuff.
You don't use supermarkets, right?
I don't use them. I abuse them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I mean, I think there's definitely something to be said for cultural artifacts and the archaeologies of history, in particular gaming history. But as you were speaking, I absolutely appreciate the importance and the joy in doing something like, you know, bringing this statue with an immense amount of history and nostalgia back. But I was also thinking about Buddhist mandalas and the way that the Buddhists actually encourage non-attachment. And so for those unfamiliar with sand mandalas, Buddhist priests and monks, or really anyone who desires to, will get these kind of tubes, colored sand, and they will spend days or weeks laboriously creating these incredibly detailed artworks that are full of geometries and tiny little like patterns that go forever. And when they're done, they have these incredible sand masterpieces, just like these beautiful tapestries of color and pattern and detail. And then when they're done with their hundreds of hours of labor, they will take a brush and they'll simply brush away this incredibly intricate masterpiece. And sometimes, you know, it's accompanied by a ceremony. The sand might be scooped into little packets to give to people, kind of in celebration, as a blessing. But really, the sand mandala is a celebration of non-attachment. It is kind of a manifestation that it is the act, it is the experience, it is the doing that has the value. The value is in the moments of experience. Mm-hmm. It isn't in what's left behind, what's kept, what's guarded, which is, you know, in a way, a very kind of capitalistic approach. So, I mean, I think they can coexist, but I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, this ideation of non-attachment versus it's cultural artifact.
I find it interesting because, like, when you look at what I love about the theater is that you are going there on one night and you're going to be only experiencing that play in that way, that one time, and then it's gone. And then a month after the run is over, it's finished. And so when I do theater and produce things on stage or director or actor or whatever, that's what I love about the theater. And with games, it's interesting because they themselves can be fleeting moments in time as well. But, you know, just in the previous episode, we talked to John Linneman, who's made it his mission to give access and understanding and appreciation to old games that may no longer be very widely accessible. You can't even, you know, run them on current machines and stuff like that. So it's... I'm thinking a lot about the sort of temporary nature of what we make, and at the same time, it's so important to keep this art alive and sort of like keep it, you know, preserve it for history, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, it is a very vulnerable art form, video games, actually.
Yes, I mean, just games that we grew up with that we loved are literally inaccessible, or, you know, I think in some cases almost don't exist anymore. You can't access them. Even huge games that are deeply beloved, like Black and White by, was it Lionhead Studios?
Yeah, Lionhead, yeah. Peter Molyneux's company.
I looked for that recently, and that is a game that comes up frequently in my circles.
It's a masterpiece.
Yeah, it absolutely is a masterpiece. And it had so many adoring fans. And I had even like pirated copies that function are hard, if not impossible, to come by. Mm. By the way, if you have a pirated copy, you can find my email on the website. But yeah, it is strange. And you know, I have a 9-year-old son, you have children, Yag. It's very meaningful and special to us to be able to share these histories and this culture we grew up in with our children.
And the other thing that, in terms of fleeting memories and precious moments in time, is like the one thing that one doesn't get to appreciate but should, you know, appreciate while here, is that we get to see people that we care about in this industry for this moment in time and all, you know, come together and, you know, both work but also, you know, of course, like hit the town, etc. So you know, this show here started at Gamescom last year. Yeah. So amidst all of this sort of noise and trash and everything else, you know, beautiful things happen here as well.
A lot of beautiful things, a lot of dreams being made, at least dreams in the moment. You know, a lot of people who want that publishing deal, getting that deal, and that dream might not persist through to the end. Making games is hard work, people. But, you know, that this is definitely a place of joy as well. It's just, it can be very confronting when you see just a lot of forgetting of the human component of everything we're doing and why we're doing this. Games are fundamentally a human-focused medium and subject. And, you know, in the mess of business and deals and numbers and stats, is this going to make us 10 times our investment? You know, is this a trending kind of genre, etc.? We're forgetting, I think, often to talk about the people and, you know, more than the people, but like what the things we're investing in are bringing to people, and whether that is valuable or whether that's ultimately a distraction. And the way I think of that is like, are we bringing gifts to people and to players, or are we thieves? Are we stealing from them? You know, and this is something we talk about a lot.
A lot. Yeah, it was interesting. Yesterday I was at the Belgian booth and lovely people running it. And it's funded by the Belgian government, essentially, and lots of other sources. And I was talking to a guy who is responsible for like digital policy and stuff in Belgium. And he was so passionate about games. And he 10 years ago, you know, did a conference on serious games in Belgium. And he's not from the video game industry. He works in, you know, across all sorts of different art mediums and stuff like that. And I was like, and seeing people like this, it felt good, you know, to have someone actually really talking about the cultural and societal and educational impact of games and stuff like that in this place. Good, you know. And one thing I've noticed, like more countries have individual stands now than ever before. Right, you know, you've got, you know, Switzerland has a booth, right? You know, Austria, like, you know.
It's like the Olympics.
It is.
The gaming Olympics.
Yes, but it also means that all the countries now really genuinely care about pushing local talent. You know, I mean, you are here, you know,
yeah,
thanks to
it. Yeah, the Australian exhibition.
So. Yes.
And it's great because there is this level of kind of both legitimization of, you know, countries showing up and having their representation. Mm-hmm. But it kind of puts some international social pressure on other countries, because all of a sudden it's like, well, Switzerland and Australia and Brazil and the UK and all the rest have their country stands. why don't we? Like, that's, we're delegitimizing ourselves in the face of the global, you know, landscape when we're not showing up with our representation. And it's really a lovely sort of pressure because that kind of forces these countries into actually funding their game devs and putting some time and attention and money into actually participating in the games industry and paying attention to it. So, you know, talking about Gamescom, that is an incredibly important and beautiful outcome that is happening due to this kind of massive scale of event.
And it's great when countries care and also identify the talent, just as they did with you last year at Gamescom. You've announced something here at Gamescom, haven't you? A new initiative.
Oh yes, I am. I recently founded a not-for-profit with Ashley Riot Blake, one of my oldest friends. I actually met her playing video games, Halo specifically, when I was 15 years old. And yeah, we followed similar life trajectories. She's a CEO of Andromeda Entertainment, a VR publisher.
We should have her on the show, shouldn't we?
Absolutely should. And yeah, so some might be familiar that I run the Women Leaders in Games Network. And I'm so passionate about that community and building that community and resourcing that community because it's so needed. I founded it because I needed it myself and it didn't exist. So, you know, if you build it, they will come, is the hurt. But it did feel a little narrow. You know, there are a lot of marginalized people who really could use networks and communities and resources that go beyond women. And, you know, Women Leaders in Games is open to non-binary people and gender fluid people. So it's a little bit of a misnomer, the name, which always made me uncomfortable. So I wanted to kind of make an umbrella that allowed us to build on what we learned building Women Leaders in Games, and using our networks, my network and like the networks of, you know, allies like you, Yag, these really powerful resources that we're very fortunate to have in our positions in the industry, leveraging those to actually do more good in the world. So for Elsewhere, our new not-for-profit, we're actually trying to get marginalized devs from people from places all around the world who are underrepresented. And, you know, that means people of color, it means the genderqueer people, it means disabled people. And we're particularly focused on leaders in the games industry. So marginalized people who run their own companies who could really, really benefit from what events like Gamescom bring them. So access to investors and publisher meetings and networks and, you know, all the lovely irreplaceable things that simply being at an industry event in person can bring you.
I love that. I mean, it is, these places are precious and the relationships that you form here are precious. I think it was a friend of mine the other day said you don't really get anything done at Gamescom, mm-hmm. but what you do is you will make sure that you do afterwards, mm-hmm. you know, and the way that we can do that is by actually knowing that the person we met is someone that we click with on a human level. It is ultimately about the humans, isn't it? I mean,
exactly.
Some people may not approach their business that way. Some brands don't have to because they're just a brand and they have IP and in a way that the if you hear a helicopter or whatever that is,
it's a plane. It's flying away.
But I realized that I was sitting at a table the other day with a few friends, and we all had same energy. Like we could all make sort of when we made eye contact, or whatever. I realized, wow, this is a tribe. There's a vibe here that's happening, and that's amazing. And we always find each other at these places, you know. Like, you know,
we do. That's true. That's an energy, and that's. I love events. I hate traveling to events, but I love being at the events, and it is exactly because I say this about like the game development industry a lot. I've been a lifelong gamer, an incredibly avid one, but in a way I never quite felt that gamers were my people. And that's, you know, a lot of gamers, and you know, you hear us talk about this over and over. A lot of games are pure consumption. They are escapism, and you know, escapism's okay in moderation, but the games industry leans heavily into an identity of escapism. It seems to be okay that a game is only an escape, and that would be fine if it was like 5% of games doing that, but 95% of games, so like, we justify our existence by allowing human beings to escape from the world around them. And it's like, well, when, you know, almost the entire world plays video games today, and for a sizable portion of time every day, maybe escapism isn't like the be all end all that we should kind of be judging our value and our existence by. So you're gonna have to remind me where I was going.
You were talking about you love events. I mean,
I love events.
Yeah, yes. You said that that gamers, you didn't consider them as your people.
Yes, thank you, sir. And yeah, the reason for that is I'm a maker fundamentally, and I'm a very ethically engaged maker. So I legitimately make things to try to change the world. That brings me joy, that brings me great entertainment. I want this world to be a better place, and I believe art is the most powerful, perhaps, way of doing that on a grand scale. And so I primarily identify as a maker. And like the thing about the game development industry and the people within it is that game devs tend to be people who never forgot the value of play, who are also makers. And you often find one or another in society. You might find kind of the adults who do like to play. They still have their Lego. They still play games. They, you know, they play sports and things like this. As they maintain a sense of value and creativity and, you know, collaborative imagination, but they might not actually make things that get put into the world. Whereas game devs are people who really maintain that adoration for, and like understand the importance of flights of fancy, of just giving in to imagination, of not taking life so seriously all the time. But then they make things too, they create things, they put part of themselves into the world, they offer things up. So that's a really particularly beautiful kind of person. Someone who makes things, who's in touch with that inner child, is, I think, really something we should all aspire to be.
I adore that. Yeah, it's true. What's funny is that these events are not crafted in a way that allow us to find our inner child, children, because we have gated, boxed sort of, you know, meeting rooms here. You know, the tech is dominating everywhere. The screens obviously are needed in order to show off your game, but somehow it feels like a lot of the joy is being sucked out of it just because there's just so much of it out there. But when you hit the town afterwards, and it doesn't matter if you go to a crappy Irish pub down the road or to a fancy restaurant, we have fun over here, don't we?
We do. We have a lot of fun. We don't really have that much fun at Gamescom, at the conference center. But when we go out and we just sit with each other or we dance, as we did the other day, hilariously and dorkishly.
Oh, speak for yourself.
Yes, well, we can't all have skills like you.
I know.
But yeah, that's joy. And, you know, we're having this conversation because you talked about the energy of the people you meet here. Mm. And it's an incredibly rare energy to find in this world as you go about your daily life and your kind of local arena. But to come somewhere like this is, you do have a really high concentration of these, like, adults who are still just kind of little kids in big bodies who still maintain that sense of whimsy and playfulness and who genuinely have good intentions and are trying to, like, put something back into the world, to give back, and to have those people kind of collected in one place every so often is an incredibly beautiful and invigorating thing.
So, you know what? We've been quite down on Gamescom.
We're talking ourselves into loving
but Gamescom. It's kind of all right.
I guess. Isn't it? It's, you know. Whoops. Well, so much for consistency.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is another thing that we do like to talk about, is being able to admit when maybe you were wrong, or maybe, you know, your original take wasn't the most ideal possible of all takes. Mm-hmm. Maybe we needed a moment to reflect. Maybe we needed to take more nuance into consideration. Maybe we shouldn't be so reactionary. And, you know, I think it's interesting to see, when we talk a lot about how crappy Gamescom is, it's really easy for us to say, yeah, things like this suck. But when we kind of shift our perspective and we talk about where is the joy, where is the beauty, you know, we can find ourselves arriving at a very different conclusion. And that goes for all things. That goes for every situation we find ourselves in from day to day.
But we're like that also, like when we're teenagers, you know, we go through a phase where, you know, our parents are our worst enemies. And
it's raining.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh shit, it's raining.
All right.
Well,
we're gonna wrap up.
We're gonna wrap this up. It's raining now. How is this possible? Well, Chan, it's good to see you. Thanks for listening, you all. This was our little mini Gamescom reunion special. And stop by the rain. We've been rained out. Lots of love to everyone. See you on the next episode with a guest next time.
Bye.
Ciao.
Directional is hosted by Jörg Tittle in London, Chantal Ryan in Adelaide, and produced by Paul Bennin in Los Angeles for Rapid Eye Movers. The theme song was composed by Oliver Krauss and Frally Hines. Follow us on Twitter @directionalshow and listen to past episodes at directional.show. See you next time.